This week on Writers, Inc.
This will sound peculiar, but I treat fiction like self-help.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. I am very tired. My daughter got us up at, it was 4:06.
For
Christmas stuff. And like she got up, my brother-in-law is visiting and he regularly gets up, I guess, at like 4:30 to exercise. So he was up like right after that, which woke the dog. So like I tried to, you know, pretend that I could stay in bed and sleep and, you know, but it did not pan
happening.
Out. So no, 4:30, 4:40, we were all downstairs unwrapping stuff and I am still feeling it. So I'm on autopilot right now.
Well, yeah, wow. We're recording this on Christmas Day
for those listening.
And it is 1 p.m. on Christmas Day. And I would just like you to know that my 17-year-old is still asleep.
Did you unwrap all his presents?
Not yet. Maybe he'll get up for dinner. We'll see.
My niece and nephew called and showed me every single thing they got one at a time.
Oh, wow.
And then I got this, and then I got this, and then I got this.
Aww.
It's very cute.
That's when you need to take a screenshot of yourself and just put that up and then you leave.
It's cute. I like it. I like that they call and talk to me.
My daughter did something very cool. Like after we unwrapped everything, like we've got a sunroom here at the house that's kind of hers. Like that's where all of her toys and stuff, and you know, that's where her friends play and things like that. But like we were sitting in there, and she looked around, and she's like, "You know what? I think I want to give away all my old toys."
Aww.
And like I jumped all over that because I've been trying to get rid of some of this stuff forever. Like she's got toys in there from when she was like 1 or 2 years old that you know she hasn't played with in 5 years. But
right.
So we spent like 2 hours with bins just clearing out everything in there, and I thought she was gonna back out of it, but like she literally got rid of like all the little kid stuff, and now it looks like a little young adult room in there, which is kind of freaking me out too, because all of a sudden she grew up this year.
Oh,
you know,
no.
she knew Santa wasn't real. Like now all of a sudden she got rid of all these you know little toys that reminded me of when she was 2 and 3 years old. And it's both good and bad, but
a
like
rough emotional year for you.
Yeah, she wants to donate them, and I honestly don't know what to do. Like half of this stuff, like we can't donate board games that are missing half the pieces, you know, like there's very few things that are still intact, so like I'm not quite sure yet what to do with it, but I put it all out in the garage.
When I was a kid, all our board games were missing pieces, and so we had to invent new games with all the various board games. That was the most fun you can have right there.
You could start combining stuff. Like we could take the, you know, play Monopoly with the pieces from Operation.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
Whatever you got to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I, on Christmas Eve, right now, because Kara and I are packing up, we're getting ready to move. There is no decorations of red on a green Christmas tree. It's a very blue Christmas. But at least it felt that way. So I took a walk late in the afternoon yesterday. And as I was kind of making my little circuit, I decided I'm just going to embrace Christmas. I'm going to be grateful for like the people who are, you know, stopping and getting out and unloading gifts and taking it into their family. So I'm just going to be grateful that people have that, right? So I was kind of getting myself into a nice mood. And then this lady pulls up and says, "Have you seen a little brown dog off its leash?" And I said, "No." And she said, it got out. It's running around here somewhere. I'm really trying to find it. So I said, "Okay, well, what's the dog's name?" The dog's name was Henry. And so I went, I said, I'm going to walk down here this other way around the pond. I'll see if he's over there. And as I went, I kept running into people and saying, "Have you seen a little dog?" And they're like, "No." And then they'd start looking. And they're calling Henry, Henry, Henry. And then I started running into people who were like already calling for Henry, you know. And I ran into this family, this dad and his daughters. They were on a golf cart and they're looking for Henry. And like before I know it, like the entire neighborhood is out looking for this dog. And then I see him trotting along one of the trails, and I start kind of jogging over, and I'm calling him, and he kind of looks at me, but he won't stop.
Yeah, he's like, "Who are you?"
I know. He's like, I think he was freaked out because everyone seemed to know his name.
He's like, "Oh my God."
Stranger danger.
I texted the lady and said, "He's on his way. He's on his way to this such and such street." She says, "I'm there now." And before I knew it, like, you know, my neighbors were out. Everybody was parked along the streets, and they just sort of guided him up the street to his house.
Aww.
Got him in there. And I sent a little text to her after and said, I hear that Henry's home safe. So it's a Christmas miracle. And she agreed. And so that was, I count that as the second best Christmas ever. First best was
that
Jesus,
is not a Hallmark movie ending. I don't know what.
Yeah, it's a very nice Christmas story, Kevin. Nice work.
I'm going to be writing about that in full on my Substack, so you guys tune in.
We'll call Reese Witherspoon right after the podcast.
Yeah, perfect.
Figure out how to make that happen. All right. What is in the news?
Well, good-looking man rescues dog on Christmas Eve. Oh, wait. No, we just did that one. Actually, I love this story. How a nearly 70-year-old debut novelist published 2025's breakout hit. Theo of Golden, a self-published debut by 69-year-old Alan Levy, became a surprise 2025 bestseller despite almost no traditional marketing, limited distribution, and a minimal social media presence. The novel spread largely through word of mouth, Facebook groups, book clubs, and in-person visits driven by Levy's wide personal network and readers recommending it to others. Theo of Golden sold a respectable 3,000 copies by the end of 2023. Then it sold 25,000 copies in 2024. After sales surged to thousands of copies a day in 2025, Simon & Schuster's Atria Books acquired the novel, offering broader distribution over the higher profits Livy could have earned by staying independent.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I know. Man, a Christmas miracle indeed.
Yeah, I love this, you know, because I guess I think he's Southern and just started
in Georgia.
Yeah. His sister, I think maybe is something in PR or something, just reached out to everybody that knew him in every network. And he's just doing the book clubs. And it's just like that organic growth. We've talked about that a couple of times, you know.
Yeah.
You didn't have the 2 weeks on the. Yeah, after publishing on the bestseller list, but just kept at it. And, you know, the research out there says it takes 2 years for a book to saturate market. And there you go, yeah. You know, it's pretty cool.
I went down a real rabbit hole once I read this and started looking at, like, his YouTube stuff. He does, like, he plays, like, blues music, you know. He releases tracks. He's a retired judge/attorney. So he's doing okay. But you know, this book apparently has a little bit of legal stuff in it too. So I went ahead and bought the book. I'm going to read the book.
I know the way your brain works. Did you figure out what he was doing from a marketing standpoint that actually lit this on fire?
Yeah, I'm looking. That's why I'm studying him.
Yeah. I'm guessing it's something that can't be duplicated, but you know,
probably
like he's hitting, like Christine said, he's hitting every place that's got the big word of mouth. You know, you get one person to read the book, they tell three people, and then it just goes from there.
Yeah. Which is not a terrible way to go, but I also think he has a little bit of means because of his background. So that's allowed him to kind of, he has the time to go hit up a bunch of, you know, in-person reading groups and, you know, things like that. So anyway, I wish him well. I'm going to study everything he does now, and I am going to read the book. All right. Some new names on the fiction bestseller list. The New York Times highlighted several breakout fiction hits from lesser-known and debut authors, including Virginia Evans' The Correspondent, which built sales slowly in a way almost unheard of for a debut novel. Books with built-in audiences exceeded expectations, notably, oh man, Sin Lin Yu's fan fiction-turned novel Alchemized and Alan Levy's formerly self-published Theo of Golden, both of which found even wider readerships after going traditional. Other notable successes include Patrick Ryan's Buckeye, Amazon's Book of the Year, and Thomas Schlesser's Mona's Eyes, Barnes & Noble's Book of the Year, while Denzel Merrick's Murder at Holly House quietly sold 128,000 copies in its first U.S. release. Industry watchers note the bestseller landscape has shifted, with today's charts led less by legacy blockbuster authors and more by writers like Rebecca Yarros, Emily Henry, and Freida McFadden, reflecting changing reader habits and formats.
Yeah, it was just surprising to me, like, how many of these authors that hit the NYT bestseller list I did not know. So I'm like, who are these? Which is kind of cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is really cool.
That's new. My niece requested that book, Alchemized, for Christmas. So
yeah.
Hopefully, this doesn't air until after Christmas.
It's wildly popular.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I keep seeing it, and once she requested it, I haven't checked it out yet, but I want to read it. It is interesting that we are. I think we kind of predicted this, that. We're seeing a real shift to people are self-publishing, establishing themselves and establishing their like platform and reach. And then the traditional companies are picking them up.
Yep.
I'm seeing a lot more of that.
Well, they haven't changed their ways. You know, like if you look at the traditional, like their list, their catalogs, it's the same names that we've seen for the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And those big name authors that we're used to seeing every time we walk into Walmart or the grocery store are all aging out. You know, they're all in their late 70s, early 80s. You know, they're just, and the traditional publishers haven't replenished that stock by creating new big names behind them. Which is opening up that market. And, you know, marketing today's world is very different too. The traditional publishers really haven't played ball with TikTok and Bookstagram. They've tried, but they don't have the organic reach that an indie author seems to have in that same market. I think it's just because indies, you know, we tend to do guerrilla marketing. We tend to get down in the weeds and we're not afraid to get a little dirty sometimes to get the word on the book out there. But it's really starting to pay off, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, those big name authors are starting to go away, opening up room on that list. And now this whole new group is starting to just saturate the market. I bet you the next 2 or 3 years, it's going to be completely flipped. You know, you're going to see one or two of these big, you know, normal names, the names that we're used to seeing are going to be there. And the rest is all going to be something new.
Yeah. Karen and I were actually talking about how we've both noticed that recently in Hollywood, like there have been several films that were released with actors who were known commodities before that have just completely flopped. And that we're, you know, we've seen some coverage of this, like, you know, I think it was Matt Damon did a movie and like nobody went to see it. And that was unheard of just like 5 or 6 years ago. So studios don't quite know what to do with that. And I think the same is happening in publishing. So it's a good opportunity for independence, though. We'll say that. All right. Last story. Why these contract clauses are scary. Because they're contract clauses, but a controversial publishing contract from Shadowlight Press has alarmed writers for its sweeping long-term rights grab, including a 10-year grant that can effectively extend for decades through automatic renewals tied to series installments. The contract relies on net profit royalties and aggressive cost recoupment, meaning authors may earn little or nothing while the publisher deducts broad, loosely defined expenses, an approach likened to back-end vanity publishing. Several clauses allow the publisher to take over an unfinished series, control derivative works, and impose severe financial penalties, including triple damages and future earnings claims if the contract ends early. Writer Beware warns these terms are highly unbalanced and predatory, especially dangerous for new authors, and urges writers to understand the contract language, question extreme provisions, and seek fair terms before signing.
That's scary. So is it all tied to this one publisher, or are they finding this with multiple publishers?
This was based on this publisher, but I think it's always good to have a discussion about it because, you know, if we see it in one contract, it may pop up other places.
Especially if they think they can get away with it.
Yeah. Anyone who has a contract they're looking at, like, I would go check this out on Writer Beware because there's more explanation about everything. But it's just good to know, like, you want to know what rights you're giving up and what that means.
Right? Yeah, you should absolutely read every contract you sign, but you should also get an attorney, especially when it comes to something like this. But I can't imagine that they're the only ones doing a rights grab like this. I bet a lot of small publishing houses are attempting the same thing. because that's where all the money is and all that stuff that happens later that they, the author is out of their contract and they can go do whatever. Like, they want to own all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they're looking at all the places they're not making money now and where it is being made. And honestly, like this extends beyond just the publishing contracts. Like my Forum K series, the first two books were sold by one particular agent, and I haven't been with her for years. I've had multiple agents since her, but because of the way her contract is set up, she's the only agent that's allowed to sell those two books. So every time they come up for renewal, foreign territories, all that kind of stuff, it's solely on her. And she's a nice agent. She's a great person. But if I didn't get along with her, that would be a real problem because I can't take those books from her and give them to somebody else. And it has caused friction with new agents. I've got a new foreign agent that's handling all my foreign rights, and she can't handle those two particular books just simply because they're tied to this one agent. And that's, it was one sentence in a 2-page contract that I just didn't catch, at the time, because I just didn't know any better. So you have to look at all that stuff. And I, like Christine said, we warn about this all the time. Every contract you get put in front of you, tear it apart, look at every little thing, try to play it out, figure out what could bite you in the butt, 6 months later. My golden standard is always David Morrell. Like, he doesn't own any of the merchandise rights for Rambo, even though he created Rambo. There's millions and millions of dollars lost to him just because of, one or two sentences in that particular contract. So this has been going on forever.
Yeah.
I will say this, it's going to sound aggressive, but it's the way to be. Your aim is not to try to, you should not go into a contract thinking, I need to find a way to make this fair for everybody. You should always go into a contract thinking, how do I make this entirely one-sided for me? And as selfish as that sounds, that's where you start, because the middle comes from the negotiation. But if you go into this whole thing thinking, I better, it's what's fair to them, then they will inevitably find some way for it to screw you. So always go in with an attorney on every contract, read every contract, and be aggressive about trying to get it to be, one-sided for you.
Yeah, and frankly, even if an attorney is telling you that this particular clause is the industry norm, you can still question it. You don't have to sign it.
Right. You may be risking a contract if you push back too hard, but it's better to do that than to just sign something that isn't favorable to you, that isn't what you wanted.
Lawyers are your friend in that situation.
Yeah, lawyers are your friends. So the one time that lawyers are your friend is when they're being paid by you.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
Oh, okay, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Mark Gottlieb on. Mark is a senior VP and literary agent with Trident Media Group in New York, which is one of the world's largest literary firms out there. His name regularly appears on Publishers Marketplace with some of the most lucrative deals. He's going to give us some insight into what he sees happening in the publishing world and what he thinks we can expect in 2026. So here he is, Mark Gottlieb.
Okay, Mark Gottlieb, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here. It's good to be here.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise. So I would love to start at the beginning. How did you get into agent and publishing? Kind of walk us through how you've got to where you are so far.
It's a little unique as far as that goes, because most people tend to stumble into book publishing out of the humanities. Maybe they were a history major or an English major, and then they realize, well, I don't want to be a history professor or an English professor. And so they try their hand at publishing. But that, I would say, is changing in recent years, because that people can now get an undergraduate study in book publishing, even a master's now. I had gone and studied writing literature and publishing, but always thought of going into publishing, not accidentally, because both my parents worked in publishing. So I kind of grew up in the business, around authors and books all my life. So it makes it different as far as that. I think there are a few other people like me in publishing. The family, perhaps, that has owned Macmillan, or any family owned kind of business. Kensington's the same way. That's run by, the father and the son and the daughter. It sounds like in the Holy Ghost. No. But yeah, so that's how that came to be.
So you grew up around publishing, and you kind of had mentoring into the family business, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, my earliest memories were around books. We had, it was like something out of Beauty and the Beast when Belle, like, that long ladder that runs across the wall of books. We had something like that. We had two floors of books and a ladder that ran along it. And then authors were always, in and around our family orbit, not just at work. Like, if there was an author who, I don't know, got thrown out of his house for too much, whatever it was, drinking or womanizing or whatever it was, he was sleeping on our couch, so we were always around creative people
Yeah.
all my life, and it's a creative family that I come from.
So you got to see all sides of it, good and bad, and still decided that was the path for you.
Yeah, although also publishing was different back then. I thought storytelling was really interesting. Storytelling to me seemed to be what made the world go round and was a much better thing than what other people could do. I grew up in a pretty wealthy town, but everyone's idea of, continuing on with that was to become like a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, which is great if you like that sort of thing. And hey, you can make a good living at it too, but it didn't seem like it would be, particularly like personally enriching
Yeah.
to me. And I think storytelling, it makes bet for better people, makes
Yeah.
for a better world.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I kind of envy that because there's those of us like me who went into biochem and then just figured out later that we were probably should have went into writing.
But you're here, you're here, you're doing it.
I'm here now. I did it late, but I did it, so it's good. So you're interested in all categories, all genres. So I'm curious, what do you think sets a manuscript apart? Because the marketplace is crowded.
The marketplace is definitely very crowded, and it depends on the kind of book and all of that. I have very wide-ranging interests because I've always been like an omnivore. I mean, in college, I remember my friends looked at my iTunes music library and they said, "Wow, you really don't listen to any one particular kind of music. There's like jazz in here, there's pop music, there's every which kind of music." And so I think that makes life interesting, and it better insulates people against changes in the marketplace when you can write in different spaces, especially if a particular genre isn't like, hot at a given moment. What makes a story stand out is, I mean, this will sound so simple, but it is, if you boil it down, it just comes down to good writing and good storytelling, which are kind of, to me, a little bit different things. Writing is just sort of the quality of the work, its appearance. There's other things that go into writing, but and then the storytelling to me is more so the plot or how the character develops across, the course of a book, those sorts of things. And I know there's a lot to getting published, but it's for authors of fiction at least, simply about quality of writing, and then by extension of that, the author will become a household name.
Yeah. So is that the same sort of thing that would make you share a book with someone, or what would it take for you to kind of make a personal recommendation, like, hey, you should read this book?
Oh, well, when you say personal recommendation, you mean to like
Like to a
a
friend.
friend?
Yeah.
Oh, well, when it comes to that, sometimes this will sound peculiar, but sometimes I treat fiction like self-help. If I hear from a friend who's going through something in life, if I hand that person a self-help book, I think they might be, insulted by
Yeah.
that, or they might feel like I'm just sort of prying too much into their life. But if I know there's a book where there's a character who's been through the same thing and comes out the other side better for it, I give that sort of book to my friend to read, so fiction, and I think fiction in a lot of ways can have a stronger and more lasting effect than, simply coming to nonfiction for like prescriptive advice, because it is very dry. I guess it's the kind of thing It depends on the kind of thing you're coming to nonfiction for.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, for like a very deep personal growth or really, really important lesson, like the best way you can learn it is to live it. And the closest thing to living it, is reading it or experiencing it along with a character.
Yeah, I love that. I forget who it was. Someone said about science fiction and fantasy that it's more true than real life. And
Oh my
that stuck with
gosh.
me.
They predicted so much. I mean, I think Orwell and Huxley, they were actually both right. It's not just the things we love that'll kill us, or the things that we hate, like a police state or any of that. But if you look around the world, it's both those things. I mean, there are military police installed in cities now. And on the other hand, so it's a police, quite literally a police state. And then on the other hand, everyone is just kind of doom scrolling through their phones on TikTok. So it's actually both those things. It's the opiates of society, and it's the big brother and police state. And so yeah, I think they predicted it, and they were both right.
Talking about doom scrolling, that's interesting, and I think how it's affecting readers. And I've seen kind of both things going on. Some people are saying you should write more like the internet, write shorter for short interest spans, where there's other people saying, no, the younger generation is kind of anti-social media, make it more immersive. Do you have any kind of thoughts on that? Should we be writing for doom scrollers or staying away for that, or is there room for both?
Well, I think the good news is I think just as many people as ever are reading. They're just reading in kind of like what you say, new and different ways. I think people are still reading traditional books, or they're getting into audiobooks because audiobooks can fit nicely into their lives if they're on the go or something like that. It could be interesting to see how storytelling could change as a result. Like, actually, a long time ago, storytelling was, I mean, if you look at Homer, it was epic poetry. It was these songs that were, memorized and recited. They weren't like yet fully written down. And so they were kind of passed down that way, like Viking sagas and things like that. And so I would imagine, like, that's why, like, later in Shakespeare's time, and, that's why poetry was still like a very big thing, in the written word. And today, like, that's changed quite a bit. And where it could be headed, who knows? Maybe people will get books and stories and bite-sized information like that because it's sort of what they've grown accustomed to.
Yeah, I kind of saw that episodic podcasts are starting to be a thing. I saw that they're actually asking for rights, some of the traditional publishers, which is interesting to me because that's definitely different than what we've seen in the past.
Well, I mean, we were talking about your War of the Worlds poster in the background there beforehand, and that kind of started as like a radio type of thing where they freaked everyone out. They kind of played a prank on everyone, and people thought the world was actually being invaded by aliens from outer space, and then it was later written down. So I don't know. I think what it really goes to, though, the heart of it is that there's a story in everything, whether it be a painting, a song, a movie, the book is going to have a story, of course. So there's a story behind everything, there's a story in everything, and it's sort of how you tell that story or what the means of delivery is.
Everybody has a story. There's a story behind everything. How does an author know if their story is marketable or commercial enough?
That's a good question. I mean, I think if you're writing genre fiction, hopefully you're reading a lot of it, and or at least keeping an eye on the bestsellers list to see what's kind of working in that space. But you have to sort of know what the reader expectations are, and to kind of have a feel for it, you need to see how the masters kind of did those sorts of things. Although famously, there's an author we used to work with, Janet Vonovich, who she said she didn't read her contemporaries because she didn't want to be influenced by them, but instead she said she watched a lot of TV. And I guess she got a lot, from TV and into her books. But you know, to be living life, experiencing life, or at least absorbing it. Like, you know, the French, they turn their chairs out so that they can see beyond the cafe, you know, to do all the sort of people watching and to imagine what their lives must be as people walk by. And so I think that's really important, like to just to be observant like that as a storyteller. But a lot of writers will, you know, they'll join professional organizations like conferences and workshops for networking and things like that. You know, they'll see what publishers are featuring, the kinds of books on their website or the kinds of deals agents are doing, all those sorts of things. But I think the best is always just to be reading those books, so you really have a feel for them. You have to know the classics, and you have to know what like the masters of the genre did in order to kind of spin it in a newer, different way.
Yeah, I love that. I think if you're writing, you have to be reading a lot. I think Janet was an exception to the rule. I don't think that that's the rule.
But, and who knows? Yeah. She may have been reading a lot more in the past.
Yeah, that's true too. So, okay. So you're reading a lot in your genre. You're watching the market. What do you think about platform? How important is platform for authors who are querying, looking to get an agent?
More so important for a nonfiction author, but, you know, I suppose it could never help. And a platform, I think, you know, for your listeners, what you mean by that is basically people want to know that you're saying something from a Broadway stage and not a soapbox. And it's important for nonfiction because publishers of nonfiction realized some years ago that nonfiction doesn't sell in numbers as big as fiction, and that they really need the audience to kind of be baked in already. And platform can equate with any number of things. It doesn't have to mean like, oh, this person has a million social media followers. It could mean like they have a lot of website visitors. They have a big newsletter subscriber base. They do speaking events, or they're tied in with whichever organization, you know, things like that. There are different ways of conceiving of and building a platform, is my point. For fiction, still, it's very, I would say fiction is author driven, whereas nonfiction is platform driven. Author driven being, again, that the author, you know, again, through quality of writing and storytelling, will become a brand or a household name. Readers will know what to come to expect of like a James Patterson, because each of his books is going to be like another potato chip.
Yeah.
You know? So platform more so key to nonfiction, but eventually when you become a big best-selling author of fiction, in effect, you have a big platform. You have a big reader base. So they kind of converge there, I think. But I don't think it could hurt in either case to have a big platform.
To have a big platform. Yeah. Is there anything you would suggest for maybe a fiction author looking to start a platform?
Well, I mean, for debut authors, it's really going to, no publisher will really expect that they have a big platform behind them. They're going to really just be looking at the writing and storytelling, but the sorts of bells and whistles they can put on it are, you know, writers will sometimes go out, they'll get an MFA degree, or they'll attend prestigious conferences or workshops. They'll publish their work in literary magazines and journals, or they'll get blurbs from other authors. And so, again, they're beautiful ornaments on the Christmas tree.
Yeah.
But none of that will stand without the Christmas tree.
Yeah.
So you've got to have, you know, the story, the writing behind all of it. And fiction is harder in some ways, because you've got to, regardless of having the platform, not necessarily needing that starting out in terms of fiction, you really do have to put all of your cards on the table, because those books are sold off of full manuscripts. So you have to have the conviction to write it. Whereas nonfiction, you can sell books off of a book proposal and a couple of sample chapters. So you can sort of churn through ideas if one doesn't work. And you don't fully have to write a new proposal each time from the ground up, because you've filled out most of the proposal with your information. But they each present their own set of challenges, you know?
Yeah. But fiction is mainly quality of the work. That's really where you should put your time and effort.
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah. And just, just continuing to make it better, like not just simply writing it and then sending it out. Although that'd be pretty cool if someone could just write it and then it's perfect and ready to go. But yeah, polishing it, taking the work as far as you can before, you know, going out there into the world with it.
Yeah. So are you editorial as an agent, or do writers now need to show up with works that are pretty well ready to go on submission?
I mean, I do think no matter what, before starting any of the publishing process, it's good for writers to just read their own work, polish it as much as they can. You know, sometimes they show it to a group of readers or they get it workshopped ahead of time. Then, once they feel like they've taken their book as far as they can, approaching agents, and even then, like a lot of agents and agencies will perform editorial work ahead of approaching publishers, but it really depends, you know, on the individual needs of the manuscript. I would say most of the editing that takes place is sort of broader stroke, big idea kind of editing, less so the nitty-gritty of like copy editing and proofreading and things like that, which take place later in the publishing process. I was remarking today to a colleague of mine, I remembered like when I started in publishing, I would print out my manuscripts and then I had a red pen and I would write my editorial notes on the blank one blank side of the page, you know, because I printed them one-sided. And then I would line edit everything and perform a copy edit. And a colleague of mine came in and it looked like this manuscript was just all marked up red. And he said, What are you doing? And I said, I'm editing this thing. And he said, no, just write an editorial letter. He was like, you'll never get through that. Like, it's just going to take forever. But, you know, I knew all the copy editor hand markings from having studied them, and it's something I enjoyed doing. And yeah, so I had done quite a bit of that. But now, more so, we kind of give people the big ideas of what we think their manuscript needs.
Yeah, that makes more sense. Like the big picture editing. Yeah, you're not going to get through very many manuscripts if you're doing line edits and copy edits, right? So if you had a book that you liked, but maybe it just wasn't quite working, maybe the ending wasn't working, how would you help a writer get on the path to fixing their book?
Well, I really would have only taken a manuscript on if I thought it could work.
Yeah.
And even if there were issues with it, that I could still see a path to victory. But then sometimes clients will write something that ends up needing work. And we do that. You know, we go through it with them. But also by that point in time, most of them will have established themselves and have publishers. And so what we tend to submit at that point in time to publishers is not usually a full manuscript, but what constitutes like option material, which is basically like a sample of the manuscript and either like a detailed outline or synopsis. And so they'll basically begin the publishing and editing process in earnest, you know, after a book is sold to the publisher. And they'll go through those edits at that point in time. So I had a client who actually, the author had self-published the book, but he had sold other books to that publisher, and the publisher loved the idea, but he felt it needed work. And so we gave him some editorial feedback, as did the publisher, and he's doing a new polish on the manuscript.
That's great. Yeah, that's great to get an inside look at that process. So I'm just curious, is there anything that you wish that authors knew about agenting or would ask, but that people don't ask you? I know that's a bit of a nebulous question that might take a little thought.
That I wish authors knew. In a perfect world, we would want to be able to read everything and sell everything. And it's not a perfect world. And, you know, we get a lot of queries and we respond to everything where we request material. Like if we receive a query letter, it sounds good, and I ask for the manuscript, my MO is to always read quickly and respond, give feedback, you know, whatever it is, if we're taking the client on or not. But we can't respond to every query letter because it's hundreds of those coming in all the time. And so the website generates a receipt that we've received it, and that if we're interested, we'll be in touch. But yeah, I would love in a perfect world, of course, that time was infinite and that we could sell everything and respond to everyone. And you know, the other thing is, I would want people to know that agents are really creative conduits. You know, like if we like an idea, it's because we feel we can sell it.
Yeah.
And if we don't, it's not for personal reasons. It's like we just don't feel that we can sell it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think those are a couple of big things. But I think incoming clients should also know, like, they're very central to the process. They're in the driver's seat. You know, it's not enough to simply write the manuscript and then hand it off. Like, they'll be very involved throughout the publishing process. So yeah, for them to be will know to know and to be willing that they're going to have to take an active role is really important.
Yeah, I love that. We have those conversations kind of as writers amongst each other. And it's a weird business because it's art, but now you're making art a product. So you kind of have to take the personal feelings out of it to be successful. And you know, I've said to other people, you don't have to sell it. Like you can just write to write. Once you're deciding, I want this to be a product, then you have to not take things personally, or it's not going to go too well.
Yeah, I mean, I had a friend who's a sculptress. That's actually a word. If you're a female sculptor, it's sculptress. They haven't made it, you know, one word like they
Not
did
like
with
actor.
or waiter and
Yeah.
waitress. Now it's just
Yeah.
waiter. So she's a sculptress. She likes it. She says it sounds like sorceress. I told her though, I said, you might, starting out, have to make the salt and pepper shakers, you know, before you're selling the giant lawn ornaments. And so yeah, there is art for commerce, and but I think also to a large extent, I mean, I don't know. There could be people like this out there, but I feel like when something is created, and it's taken out of someone's mind and it's just basically made real in the world, it's meant to be shared. I'm not sure if there's art where it's simply not for people or not for public consumption. I feel like people put things out into the world because it needs to be out there. It needs to be seen or heard in some way. And so, but I think this is maybe more what you were talking about. There's stuff which I would call like challenging art. So for instance, you know, kind of easygoing art would be a Georgia O'Keeffe painting. They're beautiful flowers and desert landscapes, pastel colors. Anyone can like a Georgia O'Keeffe painting because they all belong on a Hallmark gift card. She's still an amazing artist, and there's more depth to her work than that. But anyone can like a Georgia O'Keeffe painting. It's hard not to. Whereas if you look at painting by Picasso, like Guernica, which was, you know, about all those people who were bombed in Spain, you know, and it's a horrific sight, but an important work. You know, that's something I would call like challenging art. You know, it's not pretty to look at, but it definitely makes you think. And there is always, you know, a lot of both of those.
Yeah, it's just like genres. There are more niche markets and then there are wider readers. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, like a difference between, yeah, literary fiction and commercial fiction too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I'm curious. You've been doing this for a while, but are you 10 years agenting now, something like that?
I've been at the company where I'm at for around 15 years. I was at Penguin Books
Oh, wow.
before that. And yeah, it goes fast. Yeah, I just did my 350th book deal.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm leading the publishing industry in fiction deals, and the agency where I work in lifetime number of book deals. I haven't been at the agency as long as some other people. And I found out in this most recent 6 month period, leading the agency where I work in amount of money for deals, which is great. I hope it stays that way, although who knows?
Yeah, that's what kind of what I was going to ask. Is there anything up to this point that you're most proud of, or what are you most proud of in your career so far?
You know, I mean, look, if I hear that a book changed someone's life in a really positive way, then actually that's what I'll be really proud of. There are books that, sold for a lot of money or were commercial success, but I want books to make the world a better place too. There are stories and books, different things that excite me. There's a book that published recently by John A. McDermott called The Last Spirits of Manhattan, and it's based on a true story. So the author, his aunt owned this old Victorian mansion on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. It's still there. And famously, Alfred Hitchcock, in honor of his movie Psycho, hosted a lavish party there with actors and all the people in his interesting kind of orbit. And he thought it would be a kitschy thing to hire professional actors to come and play ghosts at the party. Time magazine covered the event. What happens in the book is it centers around, one of the people at the party and the fact that ghosts, real ghosts, end up showing up and how a lot of ghosts have unfinished business. It was a debut, the author, he told me about it. From the moment he told me, I said, "Oh, I can sell this." And he said, "Really?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You haven't read the book yet." I said, "I have to know that what everything you're saying could be backed up by your writing. But yeah, I can, if the writing's good, I can sell this." And so, I didn't think I would ever be talking to him because I think the first time he met me, I had gone to the Writers League of Texas. This was like 10 or 15 years ago, and I looked very young for my age. I was young for my age, and someone wanted to introduce me to him, and he was on the board of directors there, and he said, "I don't want to talk to him. He looks like a kid." But anyway, we pitched his book. It was the dead of summer where normally people say you don't try and sell a book in August, but Peter Borland at Atria bought it. He's the editor to Frederick Bachman and Jana Ivanovich, and he's done a Colleen Hoover book or two and big name authors. And so people are probably afraid to send him books. He doesn't buy a whole lot, but he bought it. And John told me, I later found out I wasn't his first agent. He had maybe two or three agents before me, and there were five manuscripts before this one, different book he had tried to sell. And he at one point he gave up on writing. He was so frustrated, but he came back to it, and it worked out. So I don't know. You have to have in this business, I think you have to have a lot of tenacity, and just you got to just stay determined and keep going no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's really what it is patience and optimistic tenacity. You can't give up on yourself. So,
Oh yeah, you could be
yeah.
surprised. I mean, there are a lot of stories like that. I mean, his is not the only one. It's not unique to him.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. I have taken up enough of your time. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and sharing what you do with our audience.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me. Anytime, always glad to help you or the show, and it's terrific what you do. So thank you very much.
Okay. First of all, I want a two-story bookcase with a ladder.
Dude, yes. Are you kidding me? He's like, I grew up in this. I'm like, that, what? God, my parents really let me down. I tell you what.
Does having boxes and boxes of books in the attic count? Because I had that.
Oh, you gotta have the
I mean, we had a ladder.
You can build these at home. I have two of them in my house. So I buy the bookcases from IKEA. You can buy the ladder on Amazon, and they come in various lengths. And you can put it all together for, I think the ladder's maybe $300 or $400. But yeah, there's nothing cooler than a two-story bookshelf.
I have it too. It's just that the bookshelf is only 4 feet high, so the ladder.
Ladder's a little overkill. It still looks cool in the room, though.
Also really liked that he said fiction can be just as instructional as nonfiction, because I can't tell you how many almost fistfights I've gotten into with people over that exact topic.
Yeah, I like that. I'm like, oh, you need some self-help. And people won't read self-help books, or most people won't. It's like, here's some fiction.
Yeah, it's like it's buried. I really like that. I think that there is so much truth that you can find in fiction, that people sometimes sort of like, I don't know, get snobby about, but there's some life lessons in there.
This makes me want to write a book about a psychologist, as the main character, but have him give out like the absolute worst advice through the whole book.
No, why?
Sadie, why?
I like this. I support this. I will co-author this with you.
Oh God, what have we done?
Oh.
That's a Kevin Thomason book right there.
Yeah, no, I mean, when you think about it, there's definitely been fiction in my life that has been comforting or helpful when you're going through something. So, as
I
you know.
agree wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, some of the best life advice I've ever gotten has come from fiction and from, and not always the fiction you think. It's not always like literary fiction or something like that. Like I've read like hard sci-fi stuff that, had some little nugget of wisdom that comes back into my head all the time and reminds me, I don't know. I mean, look at Star Wars. There's
Those deep, profound truths.
Exactly. So
It was kind of a relief for me to hear that you can still get an agent in fiction without a massive platform, as it's becoming more and more important. It's like you can still do it after, which
yeah,
is
I think
good.
that's always been the case with fiction, though. I mean, I know the platform is like almost mandatory with nonfiction because you have to prove, like he was saying, nonfiction sells differently because you sell on proposal. And so, like, anyone can write a proposal and they want to see, like, why, I guess, why your perspective matters, which is why the platform matters. But with fiction, you've already written the manuscript, so they kind of already know, is it good? Could it sell? Is it marketable?
Mark said sometimes you have to start out making the salt and pepper shakers in art. And it reminded me, and I can't remember, I was having a conversation with someone who I think taught an MFA class, like a class, and one of the students showed their poetry to this big author, and he said, "Kid, you got to start with the rhymey dimey stuff first." So it kind of reminded me of that. I'm just like, what do you think about that?
I mean, you've got to know the rules before you can break them, which I guess is the moral of the story.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think like if you look at a lot of authors, if you go back to their debut, like most of them, their debut is pretty, even if it's sort of like unconventional or like a surprising story, like it follows like the rules of the genre and like the beats. I think it's like, I don't want to use the word safer, but almost like safer, right? Like they have to prove that they can do it. And then like each subsequent book sort of gets a little bit wilder. I suppose there are some debut authors that can be sort of rule breakers from the start, but I would still argue that in a lot of those, you can find the actual rules nestled. They're just better at hiding it.
I think a lot of us, when you're writing that first book, first of all, you've got so much time to do it. There's nobody staring over your shoulder waiting on it. But because we're all playing towards that same audience, we're trying to get an agent, we're trying to get an editor, trying to get a publisher. You want to play by those rules, and I think subconsciously you're afraid to break the rules just because you don't want to do something that's going to turn one of those people against you. You want to tick every box for them. But once you get a couple books under your belt, particularly if you start selling really well, I think all those rules go out the window. And the funny thing is, the people on the other side, they stop telling you. Like if you break a rule, they let it go. Like when I turn in a book with Patterson, like the editors will correct grammar and punctuation and things like that. If they find something in the story that doesn't make sense, they will point it out. But there's nobody, holding a ruler over, your hand saying you need to fix this or else. Like it's totally up to him at that point. And it's kind of the same thing with any author, I think, that's established.
Mark also said, if the writing is good, I can sell this. And I just thought, I think that's kind of the definition of high concept. I think he just defined it for us right here. You know, just pitching a concept and going, yeah, if the writing's good, I can sell that.
Well, one of the things that I look for in co-authors is something I call the storyteller gene. You know, I think there's certain people that are just able to tell a story, and they may not, you know punctuation or grammar. Like, there's a lot of things they may not know, but I think all of that can be taught, but you can't teach somebody how to tell a story. I don't care if you go through an MFA program or not. Like, I don't think that's something that they can actually teach you. So I think that's what he's actually saying there. Like, if the gist of a good story is there, you can always fix the rest. You know, a good example of this is Josh Malerman with Bird Box. Like, when he turned in that book, he used zero punctuation. It was all in italics, like no paragraph breaks. You know, but the people that saw it knew there was something there, and you know, that went on to be a big seller. So, you know, he's right.
Yeah. Cool. You know, this is always something I think about too, is sharing writing or other art and making it public without making it a product or making profit. What do you think about that? Do you think that that is something you can do or would do?
It's something I've definitely already done quite a bit. But I think there's kind of a balance to strike there, because I don't know an author. Well, okay, let me rephrase that, because I met plenty of authors who were on the traditional track trying to find agents and that sort of thing, who would tell me, I don't really care about the money. I just want to write, you know. But then why go after an agent? Why not self-publish, right? But I think that all of us want to make a living from what we do, but that is never going to be enough to drive me to do the work, because making a living is too hard if that's the only thing I got going, right? So for me, it was art first. It was always that, because I love the writing, I'm going to do the writing. And when I got to a point where I was doing it because of the paychecks, because I was making my living from it, that's when I started to get burnt out and stressed out about it. Mm-hmm. So I've recently had to kind of pivot to get back to, I'm doing this because I have to do it, because it's the thing I love. And I'm going to continue to learn how to make a living, but I can't enslave it to making me a living anymore. I have to do it for its own sake. Nothing wrong with making a living. Let me make that very clear. I like money.
Yeah.
And I make money and I want more money, but I do the work because I have to do the work.
I knew someone that was in like a writer's group and would submit to the writer's group with no intention of ever publishing. Just wanted the writer's group to read it. And I always thought that was interesting.
That's almost the exact opposite of me. I don't even want to be a part of a writer's group. I don't want feedback.
Heaven.
I was in one once and I never turned in a single thing the whole time. I think for like 2 or 3 years I didn't turn in anything to the actual group.
That's interesting. I mean, writers groups can be a mixed bag. Like, you have to, like, there's a lot of trial and error, I think, right? Because like, you have to find the people who not just that you like, but that you understand your writing, you know, can read your book. Because I think that the danger in feedback is a lot of people tend to give feedback based on what they like, not necessarily like what you're trying to do. I think that's a very different skill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that is harder to find.
I think other writers tell you how they would have written it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And to me, that's the real problem there. Yeah. Like, I really want a reader and I want to know whether that reader likes it or not. That's all I care about. And I guess that's probably why I never submitted.
I'm not opposed to getting feedback from other writers, especially if they're more successful than I am, or they've done, you know, accomplished something I want to accomplish. But I am much more interested in a reader's group. Perhaps I need lots of feedback on the way I write, perhaps, but that's not what I'm after. I just want to know if you enjoyed, did you have fun reading the story? Did you ever at any point feel like you had to put it down because you know, it was too boring? You know, that's the feedback I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to get that from other writers, because that's not,
I think it depends. Cause yeah, I'm in an awesome writers group. So just shout out to them. They're all, you know, at my level or above. So there are no beginners, and they just don't rewrite anything or give you like, this is the book I want it to be. It's just like useful feedback. So
I think the biggest trick is I don't remember who said it, but it was, and it sticks with me. And so anytime I read a book, I try to keep this in mind. Whenever someone tells you what's wrong with your writing or your book, they're probably right. Whatever they tell you on how to fix it is probably wrong. And so I think when I try to give feedback, like instead of, I think what you get is a lot of like, oh, this doesn't really work for me. What if you did this? Or I think you should do this. And depending on how well you trust that person, like obviously, like I think Christine, you and I have shared manuscripts a couple times. So we can brainstorm pretty easily. But if it's a new, if it's like someone new, like it's just basically just be like, not sure this works for me or this didn't make sense. Try not to give too much, like, this is how I would fix it. 'Cause
I think it's the problem is when someone is newer to giving feedback and like they re really want to prove that they can give feedback. And it's just, that's not useful.
You
That's too
talk for the
much.
sake of talking.
Okay. JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Christopher Locke with the Independent Book Publishers Association coming on. I'm a big fan of the IBPA because they help indies navigate things like libraries, net galleys, bookstores, book fairs. They basically open the door on markets traditionally dominated by the trad publishers. So Christopher's going to walk us through how the IBPA can help take your career to the next level. That's going to be good.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.